Realizing Hope by Michael Albert, read by Mark Stevens. Chapter 15, Marxism. This chapter addresses the relationship between participatory economics and the theory and strategy of social, democratic, Leninist, Trotskyist, and libertarian Marxist frameworks. The next chapter addresses Parakun and anarchism. Chapter 17 addresses Parakun and broader left perspectives. My discussions of anarchism, and particularly of Marxism, are contentious and controversial. It seems that my past presentations on this material have often failed to communicate my actual thoughts. To correct misinterpretation, here I argue positions from multiple angles and in multiple ways. This lengthens the delivery, but I hope readers will bear with it. Marxism's features. Marxism is a wide and deep toolbox of concepts that label aspects of history and provide claims about their interrelations. Key to Marxism are the ideas that production and consumption are central to human existence, that accomplishing economic functions entails institutions or modes of production, and that modes of production in turn impose requirements that delimit virtually all outcomes and possibilities. As Engels famously summarized, just as Darwin discovered the law of evolution in organic nature, so Marx discovered the law of evolution in human history. He discovered the simple fact, hitherto concealed by an overgrowth of ideology, that mankind must first of all eat and drink, have shelter and clothing, before it can pursue politics, religion, science, art, etc., and that therefore the production of the immediate material means of subsistence, and consequently the degree of economic development attained by a given people or during a given epoch, form the foundation upon which the state institutions, the legal conceptions, the art, and even the religious ideas of the people concerned have evolved, and in the light of which those things must be explained, instead of vice versa, as had hitherto been the case. Of course, for Marxists, the economy isn't the only factor affecting society. Nor does influence run only one way. Instead, again according to Engels, political, juridical, philosophical, religious, literary, artistic, etc. development is based on economic development. But all of these react upon one another and also upon the economic base. It is not that the economic position is the cause and alone active, while everything else has a passive effect. There is rather interaction on the basis of economic necessity, which ultimately always asserts itself. Thus history unfolds in light of the pressures and conflicts occurring largely in society's technology and social relations of production. At a certain stage of their development, the material forces of production in a society come in conflict with the existing relations of production, or what is but a legal expression for the same thing, with the property relations within which they have been at work before. From forms of development of the forces of production, these relations turn into their fetters. Then begins an epoch of social revolution. With the change of the economic foundation, the entire immense superstructure is more or less rapidly transformed. Critical to the Marxist framework is the idea that in accomplishing economic functions, the economy casts people into contending classes with different ownership relations to the means of production. Some people own means of production, they are capitalists, and gain income as profit. Other people own only their ability to do work, which they sell for a wage to the capitalists. They are workers, also called wage slaves. the conflict or class struggle between owners and workers in capitalism shapes all society's aspects, including politics, culture, and gender relations. So that the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. In capitalism itself, capitalists seek to maximize their profit, both for their own direct benefit and because to maintain their position entails that they compete for market share and for revenues to invest. Workers, by contrast, seek to earn as high a wage as possible, both to stay above destitution and, when possible, to eke out a better existence. The capitalist pays as low a wage and provides the cheapest conditions for as much labour as he can extract. The worker seeks as good conditions for doing as little labour for as much wage as he or she can extract. The conflict that ensues between owners and workers over wage rates, unemployment levels, work conditions, and broader cultural and political policies composes class struggle and in turn contours the unfolding logic of capitalism. Capitalism thus reprises the class struggles of all past history in a specific and new manner. Free man and slave, patrician and plebeian, lord and serf, the guild master and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed, stood in constant opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight. A fight that each time ended either in a revolutionary reconstruction of society at large, or in the common ruin of the contending classes. With the arrival of capitalism, the class struggle becomes that of workers and owners. On top of these core Marxist conceptual commitments, there arise additional insights and interpretations which inform diverse Marxism-based strategies. Marxist economism. Do Marxism's concepts highlight what's most important and leave out only what's peripheral? Do they reveal the roots of oppression? Do they conceive liberating relationships? Do they comprehensively inform activist interventions? Finally, is Paracon entirely and comfortably Marxist, or is Paracon a relationship to failings in Marxism? Marxism's virtues include that it tells us that economics is important, with which Paracon concurs. It rejects capitalist ownership relations and profit-seeking, as does Paracon. It reveals many horrible effects of markets, which insights Paracon extends. And it highlights the importance of class dynamics, which Paracon also highlights. So far, so good. But what are Marxism's problems? First, when real existing people utilize Marxism's concepts, they tend to systematically undervalue and misunderstand social relations of gender, political, cultural, and ecological origin. Used under trying circumstances, Marxism tends to exaggerate in its users' minds the centrality of economics, and insufficiently to prioritize gender, race, polity, and the environment. Most Marxists feel that race, gender, polity, and environment are of course important, and often even very important. But they also think that non-economic features attain their importance largely through their relation to economics. The concepts Marxists use to understand society are not confined to, but are certainly rooted in, attention to class relations. Marxists examine how economic relations affect classes, and how class relations in turn affect potentials for change. Marxists in turn examine how race, gender, sexuality, power, ecology, and other factors impact on class struggle by propelling or impeding working class gains, which, in turn, they believe will induce gains of all kinds. A paraconist perspective agrees that economics is a profoundly important aspect of society, and that the class divisions and struggles economics produces are hugely instrumental in affecting the quality of our lives. But a paraconist, or at least this paraconist, also sees that the same claim can be made for cultural relations, for sexual and gender relations, and for political relations. Rather than understanding the latter three arenas of social life, and the divisions and struggles they engender largely, or even primarily, as they are affected by class, a paraconist perspective asserts that we need to understand each, and economics too, insofar as they are all affected by one another. Put differently, Marxism says that the mode of production of a society emanates a force field that affects all of society, often very dramatically. I agree with this claim, and to me, in fact, it seems utterly incontestable. But then I also agree with the feminist who says that the organization and relations of socialization and nurturance emanate a force field that affects all of society. And I agree as well with the multiculturalist who says the same thing about cultural and community relations, and with the anarchist who says the same thing about political and power relations. All these viewpoints rightly identify a locus of important influence, but each is wrong whenever it explicitly or even just implicitly denies the comparable importance of the other loci of influence. The conclusion is that there are at least four sources of profound influence in society rather than only one, as Marxism typically concludes. The claim is that giving attention to matters of race, gender, authority, not to mention ecology and international relations, primarily via examining their impact on and implications for class struggle, often undercuts seeing their importance in their own right, and compromises attention to their own dynamics, as well seeing their mutual interconnections with one another, not just with economics. It may emphasize them, but it will be mainly or even only in their economic implications. The mistake of what is sometimes called monism, even when it is a very flexible and enlightened monism, is to tend, under pressure, to elevate one realm to predominance and lose track of the priority of other realms. The point is, if we prioritize economics and class as the primary focus of conceptual attention, and raise these concepts above all others in importance, we will likely not only misperceive a more complex reality, we will also relegate other comparably important focuses to a wrongly subordinate position. This, of course, also holds for overly prioritizing gender, race, or power above the rest, or above economics. The solution for Marxists isn't to reduce attention to economics, but to elevate attention to other spheres and to their mutually defining influences, without presupposing any to be prior or dominant. To overcome Marxism's over-attentiveness and over-elevation of economics would therefore require a twofold alteration in the way many Marxists construct and utilize their worldview. They would need to admit, one, that Marxism mainly conceptualizes economics and not all of society and history, and two, that feminist, multiculturalist, and anarchist conceptualizations offer equally central insights into society and history, and in particular, that influences from other domains can centrally shape economic relations, just as the reverse can occur. That is, for real-world Marxist practice to be desirably multifocused, Marxists would need to jettison their claims of an economic base pushing and pulling a society and cultural superstructure, and instead highlight that gender, race, and political dynamics can all affect what goes on in workplaces, allocation, and consumption, just as significantly as economics can affect what goes on in religions, racial communities, families, and governments. Marxism would need to recognize all directions of causality, instead of exclusively or even just primarily emphasizing only causality from economics to the rest of society, and would have to refine many of its concepts accordingly. This type of critique has in the past propelled feminists to create socialist feminism, to try to merge insights from gender-focused and class-focused analysis, and has led as well to variants of anarcho-Marxism, Marxist nationalism, and other approaches, right up to frameworks that centrally address economics, polity, culture, and kinship, all on a par. The upshot is that while the observation, criticism, that Marxism has been overly economic is important, I don't think it is devastating. Many Marxists accept this criticism already, and all Marxists could relatively easily adopt the more complex formulation described above, that influences from race, gender, sexuality, and authority can mould the economy just as the reverse can occur, and that groups defined by those other core features can be as central actors in historical struggle and change as classes can. If insufficiently highlighting and comprehending other spheres of social life in their own right were Marxism's only problem, it wouldn't cause me to reject Marxism. But to try, as I have in the past, along with others, to incorporate new insights to it. Marxism and class. But an overly economic emphasis is not the only problem of Marxism that I wish to feature in this chapter, partly because it is relatively straightforward to correct, and a great many Marxists have worked hard on doing so, and partly because it isn't as directly germane to concerns about Paracon as matters that I will now take up. Suppose all Marxists soon achieve an enrichment and diversification of their concepts to incorporate race, gender, power, and also ecological influences as primary. Would I be satisfied with such a renovated Marxism and then urge that Paracon is a Marxist vision? I would certainly be happy about the change, yes, but no, I wouldn't yet celebrate Marxism, because the Paraconist perspective indicates that Marxism has a much more damning and less tractable problem than over-prioritizing economics.